Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, what a busy weekend it was last weekend with the Dawn Chorus and all of that. 7 hours live on RT Radio 1 and RT Lyric FM and BBC Radio Foyle and BBC Radio Ulster and BBC Radio Wales and whatever you're having yourself. Anyway, if you'd like to listen again, you can go to the website rte.ie/Mooney. Just if you want to hear the birds singing, there's a little bit of audio there and you can just enjoy the uninterrupted sound of early morning birdsong. It was fantastic. Joining me today on the panel, Aina Ní Lána. We'll be hearing from Richard Collins a little bit later on as well. But Aina, how are you today? I believe you've got another book coming out this week. Another one.
Yes, Derek, I have a new book coming out on Thursday called Wild Musings. And what it is a book of articles I wrote for the Intercom magazine over a period of a year. And Beehive Publications put them together in a nice little book with lovely pictures in it. And it's all about how the world works, what the people of Ireland are doing to the world, how we're affecting climate change, how we're damaging our environment. And indeed, I explain how the environment works too. I explain about septic tanks and pollination and why plants are called after the saints. There's a whole collection of different chapters and it's available in every good bookshop. So you should add it to your collection, Derek.
I will indeed. How are you on bluebells, Aina?
Bluebells. Oh, I love bluebells. You know, when you shake the bluebells, the fairies hear them. And of course, in springtime and early summer, it's really the plant to see.
Couldn't agree with you more, Aina. And a visual treat at this time of year in woodlands right across the country. But did you know that a larger invasive bluebell could potentially outcompete our native one? Dr. Therese Higgins is a botanist and lecturer in the Munster Technological University in Kerry, from where she joins us now. Hello, Therese. How are you? Thank you for joining us on the programme.
Thanks a million, Derek. Lovely to be here.
And lovely to have you. So tell us about the bluebell that we have here in Ireland.
Well, the bluebell that we have here in Ireland is one of about 10 or 11 species, it is currently thought, that occur only in Western Europe, and particularly in the kind of Atlantic coastal fringe of Western Europe. And the Irish species is only found in Ireland, Britain, Belgium, the Netherlands and France, as far west as about Paris, and then in a small part in the northwest of Spain.
Why is that, first of all? Why is it only found in these countries? And describe it for us, please.
Okay, well, look, I'll do the description first. It's a glorious, glorious species. I look out the window and it cheers me up on a grey day like today. It's a monocot, so it's kind of related to the onions and the leeks and the garlics and so on. So it has long, narrow green leaves. It grows usually on the woodland floor. And the leaves and everything die back over the winter and retreat into a little bulb underground. And then in the spring, these start poking up from kind of mid-January onwards. And then around now, kind of mid-April on through May and June, you get this beautiful haze of purple flowers that are on one side of the flowering stem. And that's very kind of specific to our native species. And the flowers are long, narrow bells, hence the name bluebell. They're a dark kind of violet blue in colour, and the tips of the petals curl right back. So it's a very dainty, beautiful little thing with creamy white anthers and pollen on them. So they're very distinctive.
And again, why are they only found in the countries you mentioned?
Well, it would seem to be something to do with the fact that they don't really tolerate drought very well. So all of the genus Hyacinthoides, which are the bluebells, they used to be kind of put in with the squills, if you've heard of them, another garden plant that you get in rocky places and alpine places and dry places across the Mediterranean. But the bluebell family or bluebell genus don't have this extra papery sheath on their bulb. So it means that if the bulb dries out over the summer and winter when it's hibernating as such, that it dies. So they don't persist in places where it gets very, very dry in the soil. And so that's probably why they're happy where they are to the west of Britain. They're also not very competitive, although you wouldn't know it sometimes when you see the sea of them on the woodland floor. But they don't compete very well with grasses and other kind of strong growing plants where there's lots of light and lots of nutrients in the soil. So they're confined to kind of poorer soils, which for wildlife is usually a good thing where plants are concerned. And they grow in our woodlands in particular because, of course, the leaves on the trees make it darker. So there's not enough light for the grasses and other things to grow. So bluebells, along with things like primroses and wood anemones and pignut and things like that, all have this bulb kind of a life cycle where they shoot up from their bulbs early in the year before the leaves come out on the trees. And then they're able to do all their thing, do all their photosynthesizing, put out those flowers, become pollinated, set seed for the next year and persist and expand where there's just enough light, but not too much. So that's why we have them here.
Yes, indeed, Therese. I have been looking out for the native Irish bluebell this year and I have not seen it anywhere. It's not in Dublin, it's not in Cork, where the places I've been looking at, it's not in Clare. All I've been seeing is the hybrid with the Spanish bluebell. And this is the problem. The Spanish bluebell is one that comes from further south in Europe, a native species there, and it grows straight up, has the flowers all around the stem, not elegant to one side. And the bees love it. And they visit that one, they visit our one, they carry the pollen from one to the other. The pollen from the Spanish one fertilizes the native Irish one, and we get a hybrid that's a very vigorous hybrid. And anywhere I've been leaping out of the car to look at bluebells this spring, I've only seen that hybrid. So can you explain to me what's going on? Is it being overtaken by this hybrid, which is thriving at the expense of our native one?
Well, Aina, I'm very sorry to hear that you're not seeing native bluebell. There's certainly plenty of it around Kerry. But as you say, there is also plenty of this hybrid species. And it's funny, some taxonomists refer to the whole genus of bluebells as an enigmatic group because they're very difficult. Their taxonomy is tricky to pull them apart. So a lot of things that are called Spanish bluebell are probably actually this hybrid that you talk about. And looking at imagery, I haven't managed to get there myself, but looking at imagery from Andalusia and parts where both the Spanish and the bluebell native to here grow together, this Spanish bluebell is actually much daintier than this hybrid that we're seeing everywhere. The hybrid seems to have existed for a long, long time, from the 1800s at least. And of course, we've been trading in bulbs and cultivating plants for gardens and so on for a long, long time. So that's not a surprise. And it was only first noticed in the wild in Britain in the 1870s. But really through the 1900s, a big expansion of it popping up in more sites, I suppose, as more people had access to expensive bulbs for their gardens. And then it's in no way shy about hopping over the garden fence. So it'll grow by the side of the road. You know, it'll grow into woodlands if there's a source nearby. Now, bluebells spread very slowly. One study that was done over about 45 years from, I think, the 60s to the early 2000s found that they only can actually spread by about 0.6 to 6 centimetres in a year. So that's a very slow way of expanding. So most of the spread of these hybrids is actually helped by people who are thinking they're doing a great thing by planting for the bees, which I suppose they are, because the bees don't know the difference and they love it and they love the pollen, as you say yourself, Aina. But there is this risk then of hybridization. And they do hybridize in the wild in the northwest of Spain in an area in the Galicia Duero Mountains near Ponferrada. And they hybridize very freely. And most of the hybrids are very vigorous. They set seed more abundantly than the native species of either Spanish or the commoner English or bluebell do. And that's it. They grow more vigorously. They're bigger. They're able to tolerate more open conditions than our native species is. So they have the edge over our native species, certainly along the edge of woodlands and where there's a bit more light. Deeper into the woodlands, they probably don't have the edge. And our bluebells are probably a bit more safe there. But of course, most of our woodlands are so small that we have a much larger edge than we should have because we've fragmented them down all the centuries. So there is a bit of concern there about hybridization, all right.
And the other thing is that people like to plant bluebells in their gardens, and they go to the garden centres and they say, are these Spanish bluebells? And the garden centres say, oh, no, these are Irish bluebells, meaning that we didn't go to Spain and come home with the bulbs for you. We have these bulbs in Ireland. So people think that they're buying Irish bluebells because they're told this, but in fact they grow up to be the hybrid because that's what they are. I have seen in nobody's garden anywhere bluebells that are the Irish ones, and I've really been looking out for them this year because I really want to see them properly and get pictures of them. And as I said, it's not just in Dublin. I've failed all around the country to get them, and it is a pity, because a native species like the Irish bluebell is certainly one that's very much part of our ecosystems. It's very much part of the woodland habitat, and it's certainly something that comes a little bit later in spring than, say, the celandines or the primroses. It's the next one in. It's around now in May, but by another week or two, it'll be gone. So we really want to make sure that it's our elegant, dainty Irish one that we have. So what can people do if they have this other roundy one in their garden, the big vigorous standing up straight one? Should they dig it up and throw it away? Should they abandon growing bluebells altogether? Or what should they gather seed from bluebells that are real bluebells in the wild? How can it be improved, do you think, Therese?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit of a conundrum and a question and a talking point among conservationists. And, you know, at a time when we're having so many people involved in biodiversity actions around the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan and the biodiversity actions for tidy towns, you know, it's fantastic to see people going out of their way to find what they think is native and encourage it in their communities. And then such a disappointment then when it turns out that it isn't. And in fact, it's something that could possibly even be doing a bit of damage. So whether or not to dig up bluebells that you have is a tough question. And I drive by a house most days in the village near where I live, and there are bluebells there that must be there for 60 or 70 years, and they're probably the pride of the household. They're not native, they are the hybrids, but you know they're buzzing with bees. So I would be slow in a garden where all you had was bluebells, even if they're the hybrid, to just whip them all out just like that and leave those bees that are dependent on them hungry. I'd be trying to see what could I do to do it in a more maybe stepwise fashion and replace them over time with other pollinating plants, obviously native bluebells if I could get them. I would certainly be advising people to be very, very careful. Exactly as you say, you know, bluebells are being sold as the native Irish species, and they're not, and they're not even the Spanish species. It's unlikely really that anything being sold is pure species anymore. They're almost always hybrids, because of course with them growing more vigorously, that's what gardeners want. That's what we want. We want big and better and pest free and, you know, happy to outcompete the other things, the weeds, as we might call them, you know, that get in the way. So I would say, you know, people could, if they would and were open minded to it, have a think about replacing hybrid bluebells with something else. In terms of introducing native bluebells, what is important is that we don't damage the populations of wild native bluebells that are there. That's extremely important everywhere. It's especially important in national parks and nature reserves. Obviously, you couldn't be going into somebody else's land and digging up their bluebells and putting them on your own. So that isn't an option either. Probably the most sustainable and safest way to introduce bluebells to your garden, if you want to, is to collect seed. And even then, that seed should only be collected from somewhere where you have permission to collect it. Again, not from a national park. And you need to collect it responsibly. You're doing it in a way that doesn't damage the population that's there.
Therese, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks very much. And thank you, Aina.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed again to Therese. Now, let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, who's at his home in Dublin 15. And I believe, Terry, you were giving some wildlife advice to somebody from RTE?
A colleague of yours, Derek, Kim Burrows from RTE. He got in touch recently. He'd heard the report I did with Justin Good down in County Cavan. Now, you'll remember that report. Mm-hmm. Justin planted over 80,000 trees on his farm over 30-odd years. And Kim, in somewhat similar, he bought a piece of land in County Wicklow a number of years ago. And in that time, he's already planted over 4,000 trees. But he's keen to attract more wildlife onto the land. So I got in touch with naturalist and wildlife author Declan Murphy to see if we could give him some kind of steer on what he could do to attract more wildlife onto his land.
Kim, how are you?
How are you?
Thanks for having us up. This is absolutely gorgeous where you are here.
Yeah, it is. It's very nice. It's a real getaway.
And, where are we exactly in County Wicklow?
You're not far from Ballinastow Wood, but south-east from Ballinastow Wood, and just following the Vartry down towards the...
Yeah, because the Vartry's here actually on your land.
Yeah, yeah, it runs right through it.
Now, looking across here, I can't see a single house, and I can see for miles and miles and miles. Yeah. I see lots of trees, I see lots of mountains, I see lots of gorse in flower. It looks really fantastic.
Yeah, it's very fresh looking, but it's very nice. I mean, I've planted a lot of trees up here, about probably over 4,000 trees.
Already?
Already, yeah.
How long have you got this land?
About 7 years. Mm.
Declan, what do you think? You're a Wicklow man.
I think it's absolutely gorgeous. It's an area I know very well, but I've never been to this exact spot before. This is the Vartry that's flowing into the Roundwood Reservoirs. Mm-hmm. And I've spent many years birdwatching on the Roundwood Reservoirs, studying kingfishers.
Well, you mentioned the birds there because there are lots of birds around us now. We were listening there to a song thrush. Beautiful.
That's right. He's singing now in the background. And the song thrush is it's a species that's declined in recent years.
Yeah, I don't hear it so much in North County Dublin anymore. But just to listen to that, he's really beautiful.
He is. I always used to say that if there was one bird I couldn't live without, if I had to choose one bird to take with me to a desert island, it would be the song thrush. I think it's one of the best songsters we have here in Ireland.
So, Kim, I presume you're trying to encourage more and more wildlife here on the
land. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, leaving out various bird feeders around, I mean, even for pheasants, trying to get pheasants in, etc., and any other kind of birds. That's what I was hoping to ask about, how to get more birds onto the land and through the trees and stuff.
Well, the first thing I'd be thinking of down here in County Wicklow is a stronghold for the woodpecker.
That's right, a great spotted woodpecker, which first spread here in 2007, has now spread right across Wicklow. And this area we're in, I've seen them here on numerous occasions. There's a large quilcha plantation here beside us, and I've seen them in there quite frequently.
And how would Kim encourage the woodpeckers here?
The one thing that I suppose that would bring them onto his land will be a peanut feeder, because they do go to peanut feeders.
Right.
Okay. But they're already here and they're breeding and raising young in the woodland around us. So you don't have to do too much more to get them in.
Right, okay.
They will certainly come down to use your peanut feeders during the winter.
Right.
So they're a bird that's already here.
Kim, have you seen any woodpeckers here?
No, I haven't seen them. I've heard them. Definitely in the forest behind me now. I've never seen them.
In the forest behind you then, have you seen the likes of badgers, foxes?
I haven't seen badgers. Foxes, yeah. Deer coming through. What else? Otter.
Mm. Badgers or foxes, how can you encourage them in?
Badgers are very much a sedentary species. They will have a set that they'll have used for many, many years. So the one thing that could encourage them to come in, they feed on earthworms an awful lot.
Right.
And earthworms are easier to find on a well-mown lawn.
Right.
That's why in South County Dublin, you'll often see them going into people's gardens and they'll forage around actually on people's lawns to feed on them. So you've cut some nice tracks here through your meadows
sort of
and through your trees.
Just through there,
they could easily 2.5 feet
long. Just walks through, and I don't try not to disturb anything else around it, to leave it as wild as I can, but just so I can walk through it. I've cut a few tracks through it. But
in general, it's very hard to specifically attract some of those species to a given area to live. The best thing I think is what you've done is you've planted an area that was quite bare.
Yeah.
You've created a habitat that is suitable for them, and they will spread into it their own way.
Good.
At their own time.
Good. Excellent.
There's one animal I'm sure is here, and that's pine marten.
That's one I am very interested in trying to get in, and I haven't seen any of them. I hear they're around, but and I don't know how to attract them, but that would be interesting.
They have a huge territory. I've seen three on the road dead in the last week and a half, just around here in Wicklow. So they are here. They're spreading everywhere. They're the type of thing, again, though, that if you're not here, naturally you won't see them.
Right, okay.
And you don't live here all the time.
No.
So that in itself is a good thing, because this area then is very much becoming an oasis. It's got very, very little disturbance because there isn't anybody here a lot of the time. On top of that, the rewilding that you've carried out, you're just letting nature, for the most part, take its own course here.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
As we discussed there, the little tracks that you've cut through, apart from that, there's very, very little interference or management of nature here. And I think you'll reap the benefits of that. Everything you've done will bring all the wildlife in.
Yeah. Of course, you've a number of habitats here. We're in this lovely little grassy land, but you have a bankside right beside the river, the Vartry.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's beautiful.
And the noise from
the river is fantastic. It goes over a small stone weir here, which is beautiful on a nice quiet day, such as today.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And you often see the kingfishers flying up through over the river here, which is amazing.
That must be something spectacular.
Yeah, but very quick, though, to fly. That's the problem.
Yeah. Here we are here now, just at the river's edge. And the sound is beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's the noise we have all the time.
It's
up here, 24/7. It's lovely.
And have you seen much wildlife here on the river?
Yeah, well, I have seen an otter here a couple of years ago, but that was about it. I haven't seen him since.
Mm.
There are fish, a lot of brown trout. Not big, but they're there.
Right.
See them swimming around quite regularly. The deer, obviously, are through the place. And like I say, fox and badger and stuff. I haven't seen badgers, but you see the odd trace of them through the place. So,
Declan, is there any way in which you can encourage the otter onto the river here?
Otters will have a territory again that along a river will go several kilometres. So the main thing for an otter needs is clean water. And the Vartry is very, very clean. I think, as Kim said himself,
it's absolutely
spotless. There's plenty of fish in it. The otters will come up and down here. I mean, it's a lovely bank. I'm just looking at this riverside bank here, and it's absolutely lovely. There's a lovely natural community on it. All those provide a great, food supply for insects. There's gorse growing along the banks there, which is good for green hairstreak butterflies. It's a lovely stretch of river, this. I mean, it's one of the nicest stretches I've really seen. There's no mark of mankind really visible on it. The gorse just goes right down into it. The fields aren't even visible behind the trees and the grass. And it's a real jewel of a place to be.
It's just wild, isn't it?
It's just perfect.
Yeah. And if you can't see it, obviously, but there is beautiful and almost fluorescent green weed going through the river. It's so clean, the water.
Mm.
It's almost fluorescent green. It's beautiful looking as it sort of moves. Well,
perhaps we should have a look at some of the wildlife that's in the river there at the water's edge and just see ourselves what we can find, because there's many species that are good indicators of clean water.
Okay.
And we can go and have a look at that now.
Let's do it.
Yeah, Terry, here's a good example of a rock now taken out of the river there.
Yeah.
And as I lifted it up, a number of small invertebrates, look at them all there.
Lots of them.
Stonefly larvae, caddisfly larvae, a few mayfly larvae. All of these are very, very good indicators of
a really clean river. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as a result, you're going to have the fish feeding. I mean, there's a 7 or 8 of these just on this rock here.
Yeah,
there's lots of mayfly larvae there. You've got the birds like dippers will feed on these, grey wagtails. They'll feed on all these and give a good, healthy environment.
So really, Declan, there's very little Kim should be doing on top of what he's already done. Because the place is perfect.
It is. He's doing the most important thing of all, though, and that's doing very, very little. He's letting nature manage itself. He hasn't put any infrastructure in. He hasn't put any management procedure in. He's adapted it so that he can stay here and enjoy its benefit, enjoy its wealth, and he's letting nature at its own pace colonize, rewild this whole place. He's added in the trees to enhance it.
Now, the trees that Kim has planted here, what birds will they attract in? Because if we look at them, we see that they're all native Irish trees.
Yes, and they stand in complete contrast to the Quiltshire woodland that's here on our left, which isn't very good for wildlife. It's a single species that doesn't have very high biodiversity. By contrast, Kim has planted a wide variety of trees. We have oak, we have ash, we have beech, we have a whole range of trees. These will bring in a whole range of insects, and as a result of that, a whole number of different species of birds that wouldn't be here otherwise. For example, now there's a willow warbler singing as we talk, and that is a classic bird of scrubland that needs insects. It's an insect eater that comes from Africa, a small little green warbler. And if it wasn't for what Kim has done here, that bird wouldn't be here, because they can't live in that conifer forest that's beside us there.
Yeah.
They need scrubland. They need birch. They need oak. They need those sort of small scrub trees with gorse around to provide the insects for them. So the very fact that bird is sitting here singing is a tribute to what Kim has done. He's brought species here that wouldn't be here. But they're not artificially introduced. they're not a managed species. That is a native Irish species that would normally have passed through here, saying this is not a suitable habitat to live, and has now changed its mind and is setting up a territory and singing here as we speak.
And is there any one final thing that Kim could do to further enhance the work that he's done here already?
Well, I suppose we could look at, we've got the trees at the top and we've got the river. I suppose the one thing that we haven't got here is a wildflower meadow. Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose that's something...
Actually, I've just cleared an area for a wildflower meadow.
Well, there we go. Terry, we have the perfect setting now.
It's an area of maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 by 50 square feet, and it's kind of on a mound area, so it's kind of a wasted area that nothing else was growing on, so... And wildflowers love a bit of soil that's not perfect.
Well, it's certainly a fantastic place you have here. You've done great things with it. And I'd love to come back next year when your wildflower meadow is established.
Well, you'd be very welcome back anytime.
Thank you, Terry and Declan and Kim. I look forward to seeing your wildflower meadow, Kim, when it is established. Invite us all down. We may do a programme from there. Now, I want to talk about the Shannon Dolphin Project. Let me take you back 30 years ago. In 1993, both surveys of the Shannon Estuary recorded just 25 individual bottlenose dolphins through photo identification, a very important scientific tool, photo identification. Now, we've been making programmes for over 30 years. Mooney Goes Wild for 28 years before that, The Nature Line before that, a programme called Habitats. Do you remember Habitats? Anyway, I think it was Nature Line when I first met Simon Burrow about 30 years ago. Now, since then, more than 145 individuals have been recorded. We're going to talk now to Simon Burrow and Mags Daly of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group from our studio in Galway. So, Simon, studying Ireland's only resident population of bottlenose dolphins since 1993, you must be very proud you've lasted this long.
Well, 30 years on, I suppose we're proud that we've survived 30 years, to be honest, Derek. You know, doing a long-term project, which you have to do because they're long-lived animals, it's a labour of love. People aren't going to fund this. So 30 years on now, which is now one of the longest-running dolphin monitoring projects in Europe, we've learnt a lot, but we are still learning. I mean, one interesting fact is that in 1993, we photographed 25 individual dolphins, and Mags Daly, who runs the Shannon Dolphin Catalogue for us, tells me five of those original 25 we still see alive.
Yep, they're still alive.
So, you know, that goes to show that you do need to monitor these long-lived creatures for a long time to work out the status. Are they increasing, decreasing? What's it like? You know, how often do they have a calf? How long do the calf survive for? Where do they travel to? Who do they hang out with? And ultimately, this all feeds into trying to conserve the Shannon Estuary for the protection of bottlenose dolphins at a time when the Shannon is under a huge pressure from offshore renewable, Shannon Forest Port Company, proposed LNG terminal. So, you know, it's important that we as a group represent the dolphins and their habitat in the management of the Shannon Estuary to ensure that they last another 30 years and beyond.
So, Mags, tell us a little bit about your input.
I joined the Shannon Dolphin Project in 2017. I had gone back to college and I came on my professional practice, so basically my placement, and I basically never left. So what I do is we're out on the surveys, we're taking pictures of the animals, and then we're matching pictures of the dorsal fins to the known catalogue of animals. And then we're logging, we're databasing basically when they're seen, who's seen with who, and what are they doing in the areas that they're seen.
So the fun bit, Derek, is to go out and photograph dolphins and find them. The hard grind is what Mags has to do, is to process the images and then match them. How many have we got, Dolph? 140-odd in the catalogue?
2022, we had 179 animals.
Okay.
That includes all age groups, including newborn calves.
Okay. And you know, Derek, Mags nearly knows every single one at this stage. So you go out when she's on the boat with us and she'll say, oh, there's 216, there's 413, oh, 416 calf is still alive. She calls them her babies. You know, it's amazing that she recognises every dolphin in the population, which is phenomenal.
I'm just wondering, how would you actually recognise a dolphin? Do they all have different dorsal fins, or do some of them have bites and marks on them, or are there any other aspects of the dolphin that you actually measure and photograph in order to know which one is which? I mean, how would you know which one is which? How does Mags know? How do you both know?
Well, what we do is, as I said, we take pictures of the dorsal fin. So that's the fin on the back. They are born without any what we call nicks and notches. So they're gaining those nicks and notches from social interactions. Basically, other dolphins are biting their fins. And that then they can cause tears on the end of the back of the fin, basically what we call the trailing edge of the fin. So those notches, they're not completely permanent. They can change over time. The tissue will die so that it can get slightly bigger. They also get what we call rake marks. So those would be tooth marks along the body as well. Again, from when they're kind of socialising with each other. The shape of the fin can be very distinctive in some animals. For instance, Funky had a very distinctive fin. He was kind of triangular, kind of had a little dip in the front of it. So we have another one that I call Talon because he's got a very tall fin, very sharp point to the fin. Looks like a raptor's talon. So that's why I called him that. So you use pigmentation as well, like the colour. Colour of the skin around the body in different parts of the body can be distinctive as well. So you... primarily it is the dorsal fin, but we use everything because we're trying to monitor them now from birth. And as I said, they're born without those markings. So you kind of have to use everything that you have because it can be quite mind-bending to keep track of them.
They start off like perfect and no marks on them at all, and you have them as a calf, as a young one, and then you mightn't see them for a year and they've been in the war, so they've been fighting. So you have to be able to say, that's actually one that I saw before who has now got extra marks, extra wrinkles, if you like, that the life he has been living or it has been living is reflected now in new marks from. So that must be very difficult to actually go from the last time you saw it, it looked quite different, to seeing it now with extra marks on it.
Yeah, it can be quite challenging, especially, as I said, when you're tracking them from birth. The first kind of couple of years, they're with their mothers. Especially the first year, they'll be very close to the mother. But then kind of by 1 year of age, you could have a big group of dolphins. There could be 20 dolphins there, and all the one-year-olds are playing together while mama is busy hunting salmon. So that can be challenging. So you have to try and get multiple sightings of them. Some then, there's a variation. Some would stay close to their mother up to, you know, 10 years of age. But some then kind of go off in kind of groups of juveniles or young adults, and they kind of come back every so often. So again, it's getting as many sightings as possible and seeing them as frequently as possible so you can track those changes.
So if some of them will stay with mom for 10 years, I mean, if you're studying, and Simon has been studying these for 30 years, the life cycle of the dolphin must be, of the dolphins in the Shannon in particular. So how frequently do they have calves? I mean, do they have to wait until the babby has stopped staying with them? Or could you have one with a 10-year-old and another calf, both attending mother at the same time? Or how does it actually work, Simon?
Well, first of all, I mean, Aina, you know yourself, the ability to recognise individuals from a research and study point of view is essential. You know, birds look the same once they're adults, so bird has put rings on them, unique identifiers, so you can recognise that individual. We can't catch dolphins, so we have to use natural markings to distinguish those individuals. And bottlenose dolphins, fortunately, carry a lot of marks, and we estimate about 65% of the population are well marked, so are quite easy to distinguish. And that enables us to follow their life histories. And it is quite painstaking. So we'd estimate that the calves last about 3.5 years with the adult if they survive. So first year calf mortality is about 13%. We get on average about 7 to 10 calves born each year in the Shannon, of which, say, 13% would die. They would then stay with their mother for an average of 3.5 years before they wean, but often stay in the same group or hang out with a bunch of other juveniles. So those kind of parameters are relatively straightforward to determine if you follow them each year. How old would we estimate, Mags, that they are when they start breeding?
The youngest we've had was 6 years of age, that when she got pregnant, and then 7 when she gave birth. They have a 12-month gestation period.
So one of the harder things to determine actually is how long do the animals live for, and this came apparent when Fungi disappeared. If you've gone out and done a survey and haven't seen an individual, is it because it's dead? Is it because it's moved? Or is it because it's there but you haven't seen it? So it's only by doing repeated surveys over and over again that you can kind of distinguish all these different factors. And the longer you go and the more survey effort you put in and not see an animal, it's presumed dead rather than just missed. So we estimate that the adult survival rate is about 94-95%. So that means that once you become an adult, a breeding adult, then you're very good chance you can survive for the following year. And interestingly, when we did a study of this quite recently with a master's student, the mortality rate or the survival rate was quite low compared to other populations. And what it found is that we underestimated some of the animals had moved out of the estuary into Brandon and Tralee Bay adjacent to the Shannon estuary. So they were missing, presumed dead, but in actual fact, they were missing and had moved. So when we accounted for that movement, the survival rate was back up to 94-95%, which you'd expect. So that implies that maybe some of the outer estuary dolphins are spending less time in the Shannon and moving into adjacent waters. And this led to us to recommend that the Shannon estuary, the boundary of the SAC, because the Shannon is a marine protected area under European law for bottlenose dolphins, that the boundary should be extended to include Brandon and Tralee Bay, or failing that, that Brandon and Tralee Bay could be a marine protected area in their own right, as it's a very important place for sharks and rays and other features of interest. So that's how we try and build up the evidence and then make recommendations to improve the conservation and protection of these animals.
Do they get visitors then from other colonies, or do they go away to other parts? Because presumably all of the dolphins that are born there, and all of them don't stay there all their lives, that you might occasionally find one gone on its holidays to Scotland or come round to the Irish Sea. Or does that happen? Are they completely faithful to the West Coast and to the Shannon area at least?
It was always believed that they were just limited to the Shannon, and that any dolphin that you would see around the coast of Ireland would be part of what was called the coastal or the inshore population. But in 2021, there was fierce excitement. There was a bottlenose dolphin off Drogheda up the River Boyne, which would obviously be a quite unusual sight. So I was lucky enough, we got pictures in from a local photographer, Aidan Kern, that evening. And it turns out that it's one of the original 25 that Simon photographed in 1993. Like, I couldn't believe this. He was always an inner estuary dolphin. Like, there's a kind of couple of subgroups. So ones that are always in the inner estuary, ones that are more towards Brandon, or ones that are around the outer Shannon estuary. So I was actually stunned that it was this animal there. So I put up a social media post, and then our colleagues in Wales, Sea Watch Foundation, they would monitor the Cardigan Bay resident bottlenose dolphins in Wales. They sent me on a picture. They had a dolphin that was on its own in the Merseyside off Liverpool the week before, and it turns out it was Kevin again. So he had left the Shannon, crossed, gone around the coast of Ireland, crossed the Irish Sea, went to Liverpool, then crossed it back, went up to Drogheda. The week after, he crossed the Irish Sea again. He went up to the River Eden, which is in Cumbria. That's in kind of behind the Isle of Man in North England. And then he turned up again in Scotland a couple of months later. But what was even more interesting about the Scottish sighting was he was with Jado, also known as number 95, another inner estuary older adult male. But they weren't together in the other sighting. So I have no clue how they found each other again. That's one that's been plaguing my mind since.
And did they ever come back then? Are they still in Scotland to this day? Or where are they now?
No, they haven't been seen in Scotland again since last summer. So we don't know what has happened to them since. So hopefully we've sent on pictures to the other bottlenose photo ID projects around Britain just to see if they can turn up.
Richard Collins has been patiently waiting on the sidelines. Richard, do you want to say something?
This is a very interesting discussion. It brings back memories. Back in the 1950s, my parents used to take a house in Ballybunion every summer, and I spent 14 months of my life, over a year, in Ballybunion. And what would we see almost every day? Only the bottlenose dolphins jumping in the Cashin Bay down towards the mouth of the Field. There were a familiar sight. We could swim quite close to them. Now, if you take most wildlife creatures, species, groups have declined. But from what you say, that is not the case at all with the bottlenose dolphins. They seem to be thriving still. Is that the case? Is the population increasing? Is there any evidence that it is? Or is it simply stable?
The population has been remarkably consistent over the 25 years that we've been studying them. The first abundance estimate, and it's quite hard to estimate the number of dolphins. We use photo ID, again, a technique called mark recapture. So Simon Ingram, as part of his PhD in UCC, looked at, I think, in 1997, and he estimated about 120 dolphins in 1997. And then we did another survey last year for the Wildlife Service, and the numbers were about 120, 130. So over the last 25 years, the population has been quite stable at maybe 120, 130, 140 individuals, and which is quite small for a population. And this population is genetically unique. So it is completely genetically different to the dolphins you might see off Connemara, off the Dublin coast. And yet what we call them the coastal population, and they roam all around the Irish coast and also off across to Scotland, but they don't mate with the Shannon dolphins. So even though we see, and again, Mags would track the coastal population for the Irish Wren Dolphin Group, even though we see members of the coastal population in the mouth of the estuary and sometimes interacting with the Shannon dolphins, they clearly don't mate. And you wonder why not? What is the mechanism that stops these dolphins breeding with each other and has created this completely unique, genetically small number of dolphins that are largely confined to the Shannon estuary? I suppose that's what makes the Shannon so unique and also quite vulnerable, really.
Are they becoming incestuous then? After all, the males go off looking for females and they even form coalitions to target a particular female and that sort of thing. Are you saying that the males from the Shannon don't go off and have flings with other groups for a few nights or something like that? Do they stay exclusively within their own tribe? And if so, won't consanguinity begin to kick in?
Yeah, I mean, like Kevin, who went to Scotland, is a male, clearly. And whether he's been sowing his wild oats while he's been on his travels, I don't know. But it appears not. And certainly the coastal population don't seem to mate with the ones in the Shannon. But interestingly enough, Richard, and I'm no geneticist, but Luca Miramin in ATU and UCC did all the genetic work on the bottlenose dolphins, which we're actually updating at the minute. He would say there's no evidence of any genetic inbreeding at all from the population. So clearly that population size is enough to sustain genetic diversity. But it is remarkable. We have three different subpopulations of bottlenose dolphins in Ireland. So we have the Shannon estuary, and they are completely different to the inshore population, which roams around in the coastal waters. And then we have another population that lives offshore in deep water, off the shelf edge. They kind of look different. They're bigger and stronger and have quite different behaviour as well. But they are genetically different as well. So when we have a dolphin washed up on the Irish coast, we take skin samples. We work with the Natural History Museum in Dublin to create a tissue bank, and then we look at the genetics. And it's interesting that a lot of dolphins that are washed up are actually offshore. The live strandings tend to be offshore. The mass live stranding that we had in Kerry 10 years ago were offshore. So, you know, it's interesting. The more you study anything, I suppose, the more complex it becomes, the more nuances you kind of tease out. But, you know, you do need to study long-lived populations for a long, long time to tease out these subtle changes, I suppose.
Now, they're famously intelligent. You see this stated in all kinds of places. The biggest brains around in relation to body size are ours. And then down the scale, you have the other primates and so forth. And somewhere down there, not far, perhaps even higher than the primates, you have bottlenose dolphins have enormous brains. Now, you can't really compare them because, after all, the bottlenose dolphin is living in the water. So weight isn't the same as it would be in a forest or something like that. Now, they, from what you say, they have been extraordinarily successful. Is that down to their brains? You're looking at them now. They're in an estuary that has declined. The birds feeding on the estuary are far less numerous than they were long ago. For instance, the ecosystem is not as rich as it was. Things like salmon, which are mentioned, have declined enormously. Yet the dolphins are managing. Is it that they're bright enough to find a way through? Is this down to their famous intelligence that they're so successful?
I would say most likely them. Bottlenose are also very opportunistic feeders. They can change their prey species. Like, we know from again capturing images of them throwing fish when they're foraging, that salmon is a crucial part of their diet. But they can change that. You know, when it's the salmon run, it's like clockwork. They're at Bale Strand, just up from Ballybunion, every year during the salmon run. They also, you can kind of get glimpses of their intelligence as well. They bow ride, which is basically swimming in front of a boat. And they do, especially the inner estuary group. We have seen them, one group on one side of the estuary, another side on the other. And they joined together to bow ride a tanker as it was coming down the estuary when they wanted to go to Bale. So basically they were using the tankers like a bus service. So they are definitely, the lights are on and someone is home. You know that when you spend any bit of time with them.
Seen a figure that there's a 30% improvement in energy consumption if dolphin bow waves vis-a-vis swimming there on its own. Is that actually true? 30% is a third. It's a third more efficient to use a boat to turn up the water for you rather than doing it yourself.
Definitely. The boat is basically pushing the water forward in front of the boat. So there, it's kind of like a trampoline. They don't have to beat their tails as hard to swim. So it's definitely far more efficient for them to use that.
It's also good fun, in fairness, Richard.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen dolphins foraging away or doing something at a tanker or ship come down the estuary. Off they go, bow ride, have the crack, and then come back to what they were doing. So I think, you know, we can look at it purely from an energetic perspective, or we can look at it, they're obviously having good fun as well. You see them surfing down the waves. If there's a big wave, again, off the boat or off us or just out in the outer estuary, they're surfing down those waves because it's good fun. So I know it's a bit anthropomorphic, but it's fun. They have a bit of crack as well.
What about the dark side of dolphins? We're giving a very positive picture of them. For instance, they do indulge the males in infanticide. They can kill a calf so that its mother comes into estrus more quickly, so that they are able to spread their genes. Is this a fact? Have you ever detected anything like that in the Shannon dolphins?
No, that behaviour has never been seen in the Shannon dolphin population. It has been seen in the Moray Firth population, which would be the resident bottlenose dolphins on the east coast of Scotland. They have quite a high rate of scoliosis in their calves, curvature of the spine, and they believe that they are attributing that to aggressive behaviour from the males. The males trying to kill the calves to gain access to the mothers, but thankfully we haven't seen that so far.
No, we do have scoliosis. We've had the odd calf in the Shannon and some in Connemara, but I suspect it does happen, but we haven't really detected it enough yet. We have had some dolphins, common dolphins, striped dolphins, and I think porpoises washed up in the Shannon with toothrake marks from bottlenose dolphins. So I suspect they've put some manners on those dolphins as they came in the estuary. Whether they killed them is not always easy to tell, but they've certainly interacted with them. I suspect we always think they're quite territorial, that the Shannon is a really prime habitat and the dolphins there would vigorously defend it. But saying that, we've been out the last two winters doing surveys, and this winter we've seen a huge number of common dolphins in the estuary. And on some surveys, we see more common dolphins than bottlenose dolphins, which is unprecedented in the last 30 years. Now, maybe it's because we're out in the winter where we don't normally do many surveys in the winter, but we're getting funded to do these winter surveys. Or maybe there's a change because everybody who lives around the coast is commenting on the large number of common dolphins that we see. Maybe there's so many common dolphins around that they kind of overwhelm the resident bottlenose dolphins and take to the Shannon. So, you know, you study something for 30 years. We, as we all know, are living in an amazing period of rapid change, both, you know, on the land and in the sea. So things that we thought were the norm 10, 15, 20 years ago could be very different now and in the future. So it's really important to keep these long-term studies going. And the longer you keep them going, actually, the more valuable the data becomes because you have that longevity to look at trends and changes over time.
I can't resist asking you about Tino. Tino, the San Sebastian killer dolphin, San Sebastian, Brazil. It killed a man and injured another man, and there was a lot of controversy surrounding it. Could you comment on that and defend this against charges of manslaughter?
Yeah, I used to go into schools quite a lot, not less so these days, Richard, but I'd always warn the kids against the that smile of the bottlenose dolphin, that, you know, that could be the smile of a sadistic common dolphin, and tell that story. And my understanding was that there was a group of dolphins off, was it Rio in Brazil, I think? And people were going out to swim with them and interact with them, and a couple of lads were acting the maggot, and did one try and put something down the blowhole of the dolphin, so the dolphin rammed the person, killing him. But that is their natural defence mechanism. They ram each other. They ram, you know, predators of their calves, sharks, etc. So it would be a natural thing to do for a dolphin to ram what they see as a threat. In this case, it killed the person because they're a bit kind of soft. If it rammed another dolphin, it wouldn't be such a big deal. The problem with that at the time, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the authorities then said, well, we have to deal with these killer dolphins that are attacking and killing human beings, and it becomes, you know, a dolphin problem. But I do think, if I remember right, the dolphin group did move off soon after that event. So it is a kind of a classic story of dolphin killing human. And there has been a number of cases of dolphins, what we say, attacking humans, but are probably more likely, you know, protecting or defending themselves against a perceived threat. The classic one, of course, is Dusty in Fenor, just a few years ago, where she rammed a swimmer and broke her spine in two places, and she was in a terrible state. But attack is a strong word. I think defend, which they're entitled to do, is much more appropriate.
One final question, Aina.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Simon, about, have you found any of your own Shannon Estuary dolphins washed up or stranded or dead, or do they all sink to the bottom or go away? I mean, given that you were saying that most of the strandings you've been talking about are from that outer group of dolphins that live off the Porcupine Bank, the deeper ones, do any of the Shannon Estuary ones get stranded and killed? And have you had a look at those, or are they well able to negotiate their territory and never strand?
Well, it's remarkable, Aina, it really is. You know, the population has been stable for the last 20, 30 years at, say, 120, 130 individuals. We estimate 7 to 10 calves are born each year. So, you know, by logic, 7 to 10 individuals must die each year if the population is to remain stable. We rarely find a bottlenose dolphin washed up on the Shannon. I had a look at it there the other day. I think it's 8 or 9 individuals in the last 30 years. So where do they go to? Do they go offshore to die? Is there a dolphin graveyard? It's really a tricky one, and it's one that I'm kind of puzzled me for a long time. And that's why we're upgrading the genetic study with master students in ATU at the minute here in Galway, to look at the number of stranded bottlenose dolphins that belong to the Shannon dolphin population. So it'll be revealing. But I don't think there's any changes to the kind of previous story. We don't know where they go.
Perhaps we'll find out someday. Anyway, congratulations, Simon and Mags, and to everybody at the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group for 30 years. And here's to another 30, as they say.
Thanks, Derek. Thank you. Really appreciate your interest.
It's easy to be interested when it's so fascinating. Once again, Simon and Mags, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Richard Collins, Aina Nilana and Terry Flanagan. Our broadcast coordinator is Daniel Keating, and our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, at the same time, bye!